We're speaking with Spencer Hutchings. He is a candidate for House Seat A, Republican, in our first legislative district. And I want to say, Spencer, thank you for taking time to speak with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with an introduction for voters. Tell a bit about your background, how long you've lived here, and how you wound up in North Idaho.
My background is I grew up in right outside Yosemite National Park in California. And I went off to the Marine Corps and ran a few businesses, built hospitals for a while, and then decided that I wanted to move to a place that resembled the place that I grew up in. So I found Sandpoint, Idaho, and we bought a little little piece of acreage that we could have a little farm on, and it resembled what I grew up on as a kid, and so we moved in. And it's been, well, just about bliss ever since.
Yeah, we that's one thing we all have in common. I think we love it here. So what year did you move up?
I think that was 2012.
Okay. And you said you built hospitals. So you have a construction background?
Well, I did infrastructure. So I was a person who did basically anything that was wired to a computer network. I used to build computer networks as one of my businesses before, and I got hired by a hospital firm in California, the biggest one in California actually, to do the infrastructure work in their hospital. So we'd go build a, you know, multi-million-dollar, billion-dollar building, whatever, and I did all the infrastructure work, or I ran all the infrastructure work.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what's your employment now?
I run a gun store. I run a Sheepdog Supplies, little gun store in Sagal.
Okay. And is there any other pertinent education or professional experience that you want to mention that would be a qualification for the office?
Oh, I don't know. Not really. I mean, most of the stuff that I've done in my life, including all the networking stuff, is basically self-taught. You know, I had an employee that was supposed to go take the Cisco CCNA, and they got sick. They couldn't take the class. I had 24 hours to prepare for my Cisco CCNA, and I went and took it and passed it. So never really had a hard time picking stuff up.
Okay. Well, here's the perennial question that I ask all the candidates. Why are you running?
Why am I running? I'm running because I don't think that the citizens of Idaho, of North Idaho, especially in our district, have good representation in the form of their current person. I think that he's not nearly as freedom-loving and liberty-loving and low-tax small government as he should be. I think people kind of bought a bill of goods when they voted for him and may not have understood what kind of person he was. So I'm running to fix that.
Okay. The legislature is typically in session from January through at least March. This year it actually concluded in April. If you're elected, though, you're really on call with for your constituents year-round. So it raises a question I like to ask candidates. If you're elected, how much time will you be able to devote to your office on a weekly basis?
You know, I don't really sleep a whole lot. I've never really slept a whole lot. I get about 4 hours of sleep a night. So I have a lot more time to devote to it than most people do. You know, at least sleep about half as much as most people. So I tend to get a lot more done in a day than average. But I think I'd have plenty of time to devote to it. It's not something that I think is going to dominate my life. You know, we're talking about off session answering emails and responding to voicemails and going to the events here and there. It's not really that heavy of a load. I actually watched, I was real good friends with Heather Scott for years and saw how much of her life it took up. So I'm kind of prepared for the impact it's going to have on my life.
Okay. Well, what do you consider to be the biggest issues in the House race that you think voters ought to be keeping an eye on?
Well, something that everybody should be keeping an eye on is the fact that the government continues to grow. It seems to be fairly unchecked in its growth, and the burden on the individual citizens to support this unchecked growth seems to grow every year. It doesn't seem to be working for the citizens. You know, we have schools that don't perform to the satisfaction of a lot of the parents. You know, a lot of these parents, they're not happy with how the schools are performing. Sandpoint High School being one of the very rare exceptions to that. We don't have a lot of, from not like we can do a whole lot about it, but in our federal government, we have just basically a failed attempt at controlling the borders, or I don't know, maybe they're not even trying to control them anymore with all the people coming across. I read a just absolutely ugly stat from the Border Patrol last week that said that they caught 250 suspected terrorists coming across the southern border in 2023. And in 2023, they caught just under 500 suspected terrorists coming across the northern border. So apparently now the terrorists have figured out that they can't get through the southern border as easy, so they're flying to Canada and then coming down through Canada, and they're coming straight into our state. The Idaho and New York are the main places they're coming across. So these are things that, we need to address. I mean, we can't have bad people just flowing across our northern border unchecked. So state-wise, hopefully we can get the law enforcement empowered to do something about that, despite the federal rules prohibiting that stuff. I think those are the main things.
Well, let's dig in on a couple of those. So on the border question, what sorts of state legislative action would you try to take to address that?
Well, they wouldn't be coming here if there wasn't a reason for them to be here. So we need to kind of systematically remove those reasons to be here. We've got to stop giving them free anything. If they're not legally in the state, if they've come here illegally, they shouldn't be getting a dime of taxpayer money. So we need to figure out how we're going to cut that off, and then we need to figure out once they're spotted or apprehended or whatever, we need to get them back to where they came from, or at least out of our state, so they're not a burden on us. I mean, we have plenty of other things within our state that require our attention. We can't really afford to take care of other people who aren't supposed to be here.
Do you have any numbers on that? I mean, how many suspected illegal migrants do we have in our state?
I'm not entirely sure. And how would you get a count on that anyways? How would you figure out how many people are actually coming across illegally and what the impact is? I mean, the important thing is to, once you spot them, remove them. I'm sure there's some stats in the I don't know, I always get these mixed up, Medicaid, Medicare. I'm sure they have some stats as far as how much money they're spending on these people that aren't supposed to be here, but I'm not intimately familiar with those stats.
Well, one of the other things you just mentioned is that school is not performing to satisfaction of your constituents here, or your would-be constituents. What kinds of education reform would you like to see?
Well, I'd really like to see the schools have graduation rates where the folks that are graduating are better than a 40% literacy rate, which is statewide, that's what we're averaging, 40% literacy. I mean, it's staggering to me that you've got 60% of the high school graduates that are not able to read and write at their grade level. That's just amazing to me. But honestly, being out in public and running into folks here and there, I guess that's actually true. I mean, it's amazing to me people that are unable to comprehend basic stories in Like the Bonner Bee, or don't even bother to read it because they can't read it. That's a huge problem for our society. What we need to do is start, I don't know, change the curriculum, maybe? I don't know. Something needs to be changed in the school system. Maybe the administrative staff at the schools in these poor performing schools needs to just be cleared out, and fresh faces need to be brought in there with fresh ideas to try and help these kids learn to read and write. We can't continue to keep doing the same thing we've been doing, because obviously it's not working.
Okay, the question is how to tackle it.
Yeah, no, I agree, man. I mean, I think that I think we need to have more input from the parents, how they, I mean, who's best able to tell us how to get a kid to read? Hopefully that's the teachers. I highly doubt it's the school superintendent. I mean, if the teachers are trying to teach a curriculum and the kids are going away not being able to read, maybe the teachers can help us spot what's wrong with the curriculum, and maybe we can adjust it, but maybe we need to empower them to do that. I don't know. I don't have all the answers for that, but I know that it's something that needs to be looked at and fixed.
Well, let's swing to a couple of bills that came up in this most recent legislative session that actually kind of addressed that. Governor Brad Little signed House Bill 521. It's fairly sweeping legislation for our state. It's going to earmark an additional $1.5 billion over the next decade to help fund the building, construction, and maintenance for schools, specifically going at facilities here with this bill. And my question would be, would you have supported or opposed that bill?
I probably would have opposed it because, I mean, I'm not sure how old you are, but I remember going to school in, portable buildings or, the school I went to outside, Yosemite National Park, Yosemite High School, was kind of famous for having built these beautiful, dome buildings, dome classrooms, but they didn't have enough money to finish the insides of them. So there were no partitions or walls. And, it was far from an ideal learning, situation, but most of my class that graduated knew how to read and write. So I don't think the facilities are what is hampering the students' education. Building a palace for a kid to go take a class in that is not doing the job of teaching them how to read and write doesn't really do anybody any good. All it does is spend our money. I think we need to spend less money building palaces for the kids to go to school in and more money figuring out why we have a 40% literacy rate.
What to do with the buildings that are in some school districts are in a pretty stark need for fixing the building. So would you close those buildings down and move kids into portables, or how would you? I just want to dig in
Well,
a little bit more on that.
it's just going to be different, right? I mean, perhaps it makes sense to repair buildings. Perhaps it makes more sense to just throw some portables out there. I mean, we got away with using portable buildings for decades, and it doesn't seem to have had a negative effect on the education. You show me a building where they've spent, in a lot or an enormous amount of money putting some building together, and that's enhanced the education because they were in a nicer building. It's not, education isn't about what building you're in. I mean, you can go out in the forest and have a, have a little circle and just teach kids out in the forest about stuff, and they can learn just as well there as they can sitting in a building. When it comes to wintertime and snow and stuff, of course you have to have shelter, but having a nice building does not equal a good education. That's just a complete fallacy.
Okay, well, I have a few bills that came up in this most recent legislative session, and I thought I'd ask you some questions about how you would have gone on those. One was House Bill 415. It would allow public school employees with concealed weapon permits to bring their weapons to the school grounds. The House passed that bill, but it got stalled in the Senate State Affairs Committee. It didn't go any further there. And then there was a second bill, Senate Bill 1418, that was aimed at replacing that bill to impose stricter firearm requirements if schools chose to let the teachers carry firearms. It again got held up in the State Senate Affairs Committees. Would you have favored or opposed these bills?
Well, I mean, studies that have been done over the years have proven that more guns equal less crime. Having school zones being gun-free zones basically just opens them up as, shooting zones. That just opens those schools up as places that criminals can go or people with bad intentions can go, and they know nobody's going to resist them. Any teacher who feels like carrying a firearm and is permitted to do so, based on the rules of the school district or the state, they should carry a gun. I mean, people that carry guns stop far more crime by never actually using the gun, simply by having the gun, than gun usage, where guns are actually employed. Most of the time, statistics show that the mere presence of a firearm stops bad behavior before the firearm's ever actually used. So having teachers in a school that are known to be carrying firearms is going to probably pretty much eliminate the possibility that any kind of violence is going to happen in that school. Now, that assumes, of course, that the people that have those firearms are competent, which they should be. And there should be some kind of bar of competency that's put up so that educators in schools with guns, they have to have an enhanced concealed weapons permit or something along those lines so that we know that it's just not some, I don't know, some buffoon who decides to bring a gun to school because they decide that it's okay for them to bring a gun to school. They should have some kind of training in it.
Yeah, I think that's one concern, certainly, that the feeling that if they are going to carry firearms, they should be trained. Even policemen, of course, get tons of training in the use of firearms. And those are very stressful situations if it actually occurs that you need to use a firearm.
Well, I mean, maybe we should have the police have as much training as cosmetology licensees have. You know, going to police training in the state of Idaho, I think, is 4 to 6 months. But if you want a cosmetology license, if you want to color people's hair, it takes, I think it's 16 months and almost 2,000 hours of on-the-job training. But to become a law enforcement officer in Idaho, it's 4 to 6 months. So I don't see how that, I don't see how that pans out for us long term.
Okay, so another bill that came up was concerning the initiative process, and it would make initiatives more difficult for citizens to get on the ballot. It was House Bill 652, would have created a public review period of signatures submitted for the initiative petition, allowing more time for voters to change their minds about signing a petition. In essence, it would have made it just the initiative process more difficult. So this goes to the question of, are you in favor of maintaining the initiative process pretty much as it is, which has a high level of difficulty to get something on the ballot, or making it more difficult?
Well, I think in Idaho specifically, more so than a lot of the other states, the initiative process should be far, far more difficult. Idaho is a small population state. It's easy for outside interests to dump a ton of money on little foot soldiers to go out to be paid to, with run around to run around with clipboards and get people, convince people to sign things. And having gone through that in the state of California, where many initiatives were passed over the years that were detrimental to the state and have led the state to the point where it is, where it's practically collapsing. I mean, I just was reading yesterday that in San Francisco, they're passing out free alcohol to the homeless now, which I mean, I'm sure that's going to turn out really well. But the initiative process in the state of Idaho, I don't think is difficult enough. We really need to dissuade people from using or running legislation that way. You know, we represent, or we elect representatives to represent us. The representatives should carry forward legislation, and it should go through the House and the Senate and get signed by the governor and or vetoed by the governor. But this initiative process is, I don't know, at the very most, the initiative process should just be used to put attention on a subject, not to force a law on a subject.
Okay, we're running out of time. I'm going to squeeze in one more question here. House Bill 710 came up. It was a quote, harmful library materials bill. It allows children or their parents to sue librarians for $250 plus other possible damages if they provide a written notice to the library, ask them to move a harmful book to an adults only section. That one did pass and it was signed into law. How would you have stood on that bill if had you been in there?
I don't know about making that into a crime so much. I think that instead of, you know, going after these librarians with penalties like fines or, I don't know, criminal prosecutions, I think maybe there needs to be more education so that the librarians understand and can move the books that people are having a problem with to the adult section, I guess. But, you know, we've got to be really careful with this because, you know, depending on how certain people look at things, I mean, you know, the Old Testament of the Bible could be looked on as something that is inappropriate for children. So while I understand the sentiment behind this, and I understand that having, you know, a lot of these materials that the bill is targeted at removed from, you know, the access or having children's access to those materials removed is a good thing. And you know, if you bring up to a librarian that, hey, you know, there's a book over here that kids can get to that talks about, you know, different types of sex, you know, explicitly, you know, that book should be moved to a spot where adults can get access to it, but not children. If that's, you know, if the librarians are fighting that, that's one thing. But if, you know, a parent sees something and maybe the librarian didn't know about it and brings it to their attention, you know, that seems like something where they could just work together and say, oh, hey, we didn't realize that was a book that kids shouldn't see. Let's go ahead and put it in a safer spot so the children can't get to it. But as far as penalizing them, I don't know. I haven't read every word of that bill, so I don't know exactly what it's doing to the librarians, but I just can't see criminal penalties for that, you know?
Yeah, and that actually goes to a larger question. Libraries right now can have any set of rules they want. That's a local decision. This is a state bill, kind of overrides that decision-making ability. So it goes to the question of local control versus state control, or local authority versus state authority. Where in general do you fall on that?
Yeah, and I'm not really in favor of state authority. The only time I would lean on that side is when maybe you have somebody that's just, I don't know, they're just refusing to remove the stuff that is obviously, I don't know, pornographic or adult in nature. They're just refusing to do that. Then I can see possibly having some kind of penalties, or maybe instead of penalties, maybe just terminate the employment of the person. You know what? Just fire them if they want to put the adult books in kids sections. Maybe they need a different career. I don't know.
Oh, these library districts all have elected boards, so that's where the local control comes in. But Spencer Hutchings, candidate for House Seat A, we're almost out of time. How can people weighing how they might vote find out more about you?
You can go to the website, hutchingsforidaho.com. That's HUTCHINGS, the number 4idaho.com. Or you can find me on Twitter or Facebook, Telegram, all the normal places.
Okay, well, Spencer, thank you again for taking time to speak with us.
Okay. Thank you for giving me the opportunity. You have a wonderful day.